The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
It's Lifeline with Craig Roberts. He's the host of Northern California's longest-running conservative talk show. He's a man with a message, a conservative with compassion. He's Lifeline's own Craig Roberts.
Good afternoon, Northern California. Welcome. Just about 5 minutes after the hour, 5 p.m., as we welcome you to another edition of Lifeline. Keeping you company Monday through Friday at this time, as we typically do, addressing issues that impact your life, your world, and your Christian walk. All right, welcome back to the program. Class is now in session. Long-time listeners to this radio program know that I am not necessarily a major fan of government education. Oh, I think the concept of public education is a great one, and I think providing quality, free education to those in our nation is something that is very important to do for our children, and I wish that we could do more even for higher education, as many countries are able to provide higher education at little or no cost to their students. That said, government education, as it is today, is something that is quite troublesome. Now, I won't waste your time reading from one of my favorite documents that we got from an insider of the California Teachers Association, the Guidelines for Academic Freedom in Public Schools, which came out several years ago, that identifies a number of enemies of public education, including, let's see here, you'll love this enemies list. Some names will sound familiar to you. The Christian Coalition is on it, Focus on Family, Eagle Forum, Traditional Values Coalition, the Rutherford Institute, Concerned Women for America, on and on the list goes. That's who's on their hate list. And, of course, Friends of Public Education, Planned Parenthood, People for the American Way, National Coalition Against Censorship, Americans United for Separation of Church and State, the American Civil Liberties Union, on and on the list goes. I've read some of this to you in the past, and you know that it is an eye-opener to be sure. Well, my next guest, in fact, had a little bit of an education, so to speak, on what goes on education himself. He's the founder of the Education Action Group, regular contributor to townhall.com, owned by this fine radio station's parent company, Salem Communications. His new book is called Indoctrination, How Useful Idiots, I love the subtitle, How Useful Idiots Are Using Our Schools to Subvert American Exceptionalism. And Kyle Olson, great to have you on the program tonight.
Thank you very much.
There seems to be certainly a significant shift that has taken place in public education in the last 30 or 40 years. I remember Phyllis Schlafly's best-selling book, Child Abuse in the Classroom, that exposed what was going on in the 1970s, and even just prior to that, we've made the shift from what traditionally had been teaching our children how to think to now today teaching them what to think.
That's right. And in fact, what is happening is we have this social justice agenda in American classrooms where instead of kids thinking in terms of black and right, black and white, right and wrong, good and bad, the social justice agenda is to have students develop this nuanced view where, they're thinking in shades of gray. And so this moral relativism that is being pushed now. And so what I try to show parents and taxpayers in my book is all of these examples of lesson plans, textbooks, curriculum, videos that are in public school classrooms today, not every single classroom, but many of them around the country, these issues that are being pushed on kids at very young ages. Parents need to know about it, and they need to stand up and do something about it.
Let's talk about what they need to know about all of this. I mean, to begin with, we certainly have heard the studies. We know of the reports. We've seen the kids come home with the report cards. We know that achievement at certain levels in government education today is so dismal. And ironically, consistently, the unions have been so opposed to any sort of performance standards to the point where you wonder, well, are they first and foremost there to educate our kids? Is this about jobs or is there something other agenda going on here?
Well, unfortunately, I think it really does come down to jobs. I mean, that's why, you know, you think back during the stimulus and all the other bailouts that have been proposed over the last couple of years, and none of the spending and proposed new spending coming out of Washington, D.C. had anything to do with student achievement, raising test scores, making sure that every child can read when they graduate, which seems like such a radical concept. But instead, it was about jobs and protecting jobs and those sorts of things. And, you know, on my most cynical days, I think that public education, public schools, are little more than public works projects for the adults.
And to some degrees, not only keeping themselves employed with very little standards, and of course, once you get teacher tenure as part of the process and realize that the largest and most powerful union in America today, and I love to pose this question to the unindoctrinated that will say, well, it must be the Teamsters, or maybe it's the Longshoremen's Union, or some similar union that they're familiar with, until you tell them, no, it's the NEA, the National Educators Association, that is the most powerful union literally on the planet, all of which, and again, I'm not saying that teachers don't have a right to collective bargaining and certain, you know, employment protections and things of this sort, but when it goes so far that the teachers' rights, even at so-called educational liberties or instructional freedoms, academic freedoms, take precedence over actually giving the children an education that they can walk away with and do something with, I think it's an absolute crime.
That's right. And going back to how you opened the segment where you mentioned the different organizations, that shows that the NEA, the National Education Association, is more about, it's a political organization. It is not a professional organization saying, how do we make sure that we have a quality teacher in front of every classroom in America? That's not what it's about. It has a political agenda. Unfortunately, it's a hard left political agenda. It's run by left-wing activists that are elected and make the decisions on behalf of many of the rank and file dues payers around the country. And so the question is, that is what we are running into. And so the question is, what can we do about it? And there's many things. I mean, one, teachers. Rank-and-file teachers who don't like this agenda, who don't like paying the dues to see them go to organizations like NOW and People for the American Way and NARAL and all of these other different organizations, Planned Parenthood, they've got to stand up. Teachers have got to stand up and say, I refuse to do this. And it's not easy. I mean, there was a teacher that contacted our organization a couple days ago. He tried to get out of the Michigan Education Association, which, like California, is essentially a closed shop state. But even though he technically dropped out of the union, he still has to pay $500 a year in dues. And so if that's, to me, that's one of the biggest shams in public education, is that if you want to be a teacher and if you want to try and make a difference in kids' lives, you have to pay this organization whether you want them or not. And it's a huge sham.
And, of course, beyond that, we get into the instructional integrity or lack thereof, which is going to be, I think, the eye-opening focus of our conversation this afternoon. And I want listeners to really pay close attention. There's some things that we're going to share with you this afternoon that's going on most likely in your child's public school that I think you need to be aware of. And I think you'll think twice about whether or not you can actually afford to privately educate them or even homeschool them as superior options. Now, again, let me put in the disclaimer here before I get hate mail and calls of complaints. We're not suggesting that all teachers have an agenda or that they don't care or that they're all about indoctrinating kids. I know a lot of teachers that are fine, hardworking people that really care about kids, really want to equip kids with tools and skills necessary to not just think for themselves, but to ultimately succeed at life and excel in their chosen career or profession, but make a difference in the world, too. And we applaud all of them. The criticism today is what goes on in the agenda at the higher levels within the union leadership, and quite frankly, those that do promote, what else can we call it, but a political and social activist agenda. Think, well, how widespread is this? Where do you find out? We'll get to that aspect of our conversation with Kyle Olson. The book is called Indoctrination: How Useful Idiots Are Using Our Schools to Subvert American Exceptionalism. We'll get a timeout here, then come back to more of our conversation as Lifeline continues.
And now back to Lifeline with Craig Roberts.
All right, class, with school in session here, we should ring. I have a bell ringing there, Richard. I should have brought the bell in here. Just to give you an example of some of the agenda taking place that goes beyond just so-called academic freedom in the classroom for school teachers, but to even the manner in which the influence has taken place in the authorized textbooks. I'm going to quote on one of them. This comes from page 11 of Kyle Olson's new book, Indoctrination, just talking about manufacturing. And this particular passage, and I quote, Rose was right. Some passages subtly put down the United States. For example, here's a quote. Companies in Japan make reliable televisions and radios. German factories make some of the world's best cars. Some companies in the United States are very good at making computers. Did you catch that? In America, only some companies excel. Now, it's amazing. I mean, to be sure, Kyle, we have seen some amazing advancements in technology by both Germans and by Japanese firms. A lot of that technology that had its roots and genesis right here in the United States, and yet it seems as if we kind of take third position, third seat there to other foreign countries.
Right, and that was that passage that I quoted there was from a column by a Washington Post columnist who did this analysis of a book called Social Studies Alive, which is a third grade textbook geared towards very young kids, and it pushes this one-sided, biased agenda against, frankly, an anti-American agenda. And so it was interesting because this book, Social Studies Alive, has come under a lot of scrutiny because it is biased. It only focuses on a left-wing perspective. And even this self-described liberal columnist also came to that conclusion. And it's a great example of a textbook like that, a biased textbook, getting into the classroom, and then the establishment, whether it's the teachers' union or a school board or the administrators, then defend it. And they say, oh, there's no bias in it, and this is the type of information that kids should be learning.
You know, it's amazing because the inaccuracies and the agendizing of education goes from the subtle to outright demeaning and obvious, as you cite there in that particular passage. No acknowledgement of the fact that the automobile was invented in the United States, the computer was invented in the United States, that the tubes, the precursor of transistors, invented in the United States. U.S. gets no credit for that. It just says that some companies do a good job. Not an excellent job, just a good job. So, you know, I guess to all of you that work for, some boring companies like IBM and Hewlett-Packard and Texas Instruments and others, too bad.
Yeah, that's right. And that is what is such a shame. And what I find disturbing about this is that teachers will use this textbook and then And what is most disturbing about this textbook in particular is that it leads students to a particular question where then they have to give essentially a predetermined answer. And so it will talk about child care as a right, and how there are some countries, like Vietnam, for example, that gives child care as a public service. And shouldn't the United States have that as a public service, too? And so here you are as a third grader, and what do you honestly expect a third grader to say? No, we shouldn't do that. And so what it's doing is it's setting these kids up to give an answer that, unfortunately, the activists in the classroom want to hear.
And, of course, it leaves out a lot of the important facts, such as somebody has to pay for that child care, and that in communist countries like Vietnam, and I know because I've been there, they're providing that that child care for free. It's also a way in which they introduce and indoctrinate young children into the benefits, so-called, of communism.
Right. Isn't that convenient? And so, and that's the thing, is so do you honestly expect a third grader to say, well, how would that impact my parents' taxes? Or what, you know, and so you can't honestly expect a young child of that age to be thinking in those terms. But what I show in the book is that these types of issues, whether it's that type of issue or social justice math, or whatever it may be, is being pushed on kids at younger and younger ages.
So the stage is being set then for political and social activism in public schools as opposed to what heretofore had been education.
That's exactly right. And because there's this mindset in public education by many people within the establishment that they feel that it's their duty and their right to use their classroom to push this personal political agenda. And they view their role as turning students into agents of change. And so we shouldn't just be equipping them for life and making sure that they have knowledge so they can go into higher education or a career or the military or do whatever they want to do. We need to turn them into agents of change. And to me, that is what is so disturbing about public schools today.
And let me tell you how far some of that that change factor takes place. I'm going to quote again. This is page 38 of Kyle's new book, again entitled Indoctrination. And I quote, this is quoting an article of Howard Zim, and he writes, granted, it's good to have historical figures we can admire and emulate, but why hold up as models the 55 rich white men who drafted the Constitution as a way of establishing a government that would protect the interests of their class? Slaveholders, merchants, bondholders, and land speculators, close quote. So we have now reduced the founding fathers of the most successful and freest nation on earth, one of the few nations that has a problem with people illegally getting into the country as opposed to trying to escape. Are you listening, North Korea, Vietnam, etc., etc.? And we've suddenly now done an absolute 180. Yeah, granted, there were things about America in the 1700s that we probably wouldn't be very prideful of today, but the fundamentals of why and how this nation was founded and upon what basis is something that is held up as a pride point in nations all across the world, apparently except our own.
That's right, and it's such a shame because Howard Zinn, who that quote is from, it is held up in leftist circles in high esteem of because he is this historian who has has recast American history, and this is what he is producing. And unfortunately, he has produced textbooks. And his textbooks are in U.S. history classes in American high schools today. And so this is the type of quote-unquote history that high school students are being fed. And so it's no wonder that we're seeing our personal liberties, our self-governance, our free markets being eroded because people aren't appreciating them. They're not seeing the value in them. And they're thinking that, America is to blame. Free markets are to blame. And so we have got to change those and fundamentally transform America.
Well, I've had teachers in the past and concerned parents even send me copies of passages from history books that have characterized Mao, for example, Mao Zedong, as the great liberator of China. Yeah, much like, I suppose, Stalin liberated the Russians, Kim Jong-il liberated the North Koreans, and Hitler liberated the Germans. We'll come back to more of this startling agenda, what's going on in some circles of public education, not about educating children anymore, but rather indoctrinating them as miniature agents of change for their agenda. Our conversation tonight is with Kyle Olson. The book is called Indoctrination, How Useful Idiots Are Using Our Schools to Subvert American Exceptionalism.
And now back to Lifeline with Craig Roberts.
With author Kyle Olson. How deep and widespread is this agenda? Well, let me give you another example from his new book, Indoctrination, a teaching lesson plan calendar that helps teachers highlight for children some of the important dates in history that they need to be mindful of. Such as August the 5th, which represents the 30th anniversary of Ronald Reagan breaking the Air Traffic Controllers Union, or August 10th, the 50th anniversary of U.S. spraying toxic herbicides in Vietnam, February the 17th, notable for being the birthday of Black Panther Party founder Huey Newton, let's not forget November the 20th, Transgender Day of Remembrance, how about November the 26th, Buy Nothing Day, April the 29th, the 20th anniversary of the start of the Los Angeles Uprising. People rioted not for Rodney King, they rioted to steal. And that's the uprising. Of course, May 1st is International Workers Day. At least, let us not forget May 20th, which marks the anniversary of Cuba's independence from U.S. occupation. Yeah, nothing in there about the 4th of July, 1776. Dare we talk about such things as the American moon landing, Pearl Harbor, any of those important events. No, it's all got to have some sort of a agenda behind it, Kyle.
I'm sure they just ran out of space.
No doubt. And so many important days to remember.
Yeah, nothing about Constitution Day or anything like that. And I think, again, it's a great example of putting a resource in front of teachers and then raising those questions, because then there are other another aspect to that social justice planning guide is a question for each day. And so they're just incredible questions about, you know, just dealing with these social justice issues and all of that sort of thing. And so what I fear is happening is that our classrooms are turning into these social justice laboratories where activist teachers are turning our students into fellow activists to change America.
Well, and the other interesting thing that dawned on me, I read one passage in your book later on when you talk about the Great Depression, and you quote from another wonderful piece of revisionist history here, the old adage, those who forget history are condemned to repeat it. As the curriculum of many of these history books has a very strong pro-union-driven revisionism to it, let me just, this one quote here, and you know, here we are in the middle of the greatest recession that America has seen, perhaps overshadowed only by the likes of the Great Depression of the late 1920s. And if you try to understand what caused the Great Depression and the crash of October 29, here's where one history book squarely puts the responsibility. And I quote, "Soon, Ford Automobile produced more cars than people could buy. Other business owners made the same mistake, and workers were fired. So many people lost jobs that the 1930s were called the Great Depression," close quote.
So it wasn't the stock market crash that pulled the U.S. economy to its knees, that prevented people from having access to the credit and cash they needed to buy these things, that forced companies to fire workers. It was the greed of the companies themselves that produced more goods than where they were capable of selling. Talk about revisionist history.
That's right. Isn't that, it's incredible. And there's another example, talking about unions, where the California Federation of Teachers has produced many lesson plans that teachers are using today. And one of those was how to start your own small business, where they created the Yummy Pizza Company, which, you know, on the face of it, you go, well, that sounds interesting. And I come from a small business family. So I know the dedication and the hard work that goes into especially starting a small business, but maintaining one. But what I quickly found as I read this lesson plan was that 40% of the lesson plan dealt with starting the union for the employees. And so suddenly it was obvious what this lesson plan was about was the union component. And so the other interesting thing that I find is that, so what happens is school districts and states have requirements. So students need to get, X amount of math and X amount of English and art and that sort of thing. And so what the activists will do is they insert these different types of things to meet the requirements. So in other words, in this Yummy Pizza Company example, the art component was creating membership cards and designing a logo for the union. And so they're absolutely relentless in inserting this personal political agenda into curriculum.
And, you know, again, I have no problem if teachers wish to organize and unionize and are looking for, you know, workplace standards and higher wages and things of this sort. That's fine. But don't bring that in as an integral part of your job and recruit your students in the effort to try and then, you know, be minions for change. And, you know, maybe some K you can get the, you know, bunch of 6-year-olds to go out and lobby for higher pay. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Well, and speaking of that, there's an example in the book where a third grade teacher from Milwaukee Public Schools in Wisconsin actually had her students write letters to the school board complaining about the budget cuts. And again, these are third graders, so these are, what, 8-year-olds, maybe 9-year-olds. Mm-hmm. They can hardly, they don't even know about their family budget, let alone a multi-million, if not billion-dollar enterprise that is a public school district. And so she had her students write letters complaining about the budget cuts. And what we see around the country is example after example of students being indoctrinated, students being used as pawns, unfortunately, to do the dirty work of the union.
Well, I recall even talking to a young man that was a recent high school graduate, and we got on the topic of World War II, and I made some comment about Pearl Harbor, and the date December 7th did not resonate in his mind at all. And after some protracted discussions, he revealed to me that as best as he could recall, yeah, he kind of remembered a couple of details about it, but that they probably spent not much more than a half hour talking about Pearl Harbor and World War II and the American involvement in same, both in the Pacific Theater, helping to fight back the spread of the Japanese onslaught, as well as what we did in Europe against the Germans, and yet though had great recollection of great detail, spending what he characterized to be about a half a week talking about the results of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Of course, the events that precipitated all of that, he knew nothing about. So, you know, which came first, the chicken or the egg? In this case, neither, I guess.
That's right. And that is what is shameful, is we're losing our history. And our students are not coming out of school with just very basic knowledge about what America has done for the world and what free markets have done and what capitalism has done. And instead, we are to blame, and the example of the atomic bombs, you know, we are to blame for you know, the horrific events that took place, because you know, we're racist, or we have this imperialist agenda, or whatever the case may be. And so kids are coming out of, and to me this is the irony, is these are government schools. I mean, you would think government schools would be, if anything, would be indoctrinating students to be a pro-America, but that is not what is happening. I mean, they're coming out of government schools believing that America is to blame, believing that free markets capitalism are to blame for third world poverty, because we go and we exploit countries and we exploit people and we rape and pillage for resources and all of this. I mean, it's an absolute shame, but it is going on in classrooms around the country. And so, again, I say, and my question for parents is, do you know what your kids are learning?
And if you don't, you need to get educated toward that end, because after all, folks, we are paying for it to the tune of over $55 billion a year in the great state of California alone. We've just touched the surface of a few of the excerpts of Kyle's new book, and it's a page turner, it's an eye opener, and if you've got kids that are attending government schools or grandkids, get educated. Would you? And maybe you're going to think twice about what you need to do. And I know it's a tremendous sacrifice to a private school or homeschool a child. But maybe once you read the book, you'll find out it's high time you do so. Kyle Olson, thanks so much for being with us. The new book, by the way, published by Arthur House. And you can get copies through Amazon.com, or also information through Kyle's website at Kyle, K-Y-L-E, Olson, O-L-S-O-N .O-R-G. Again, the book Indoctrination, How Useful Idiots Are Exposing Our Schools to Subvert American Exceptionalism.
And now back to Lifeline with Craig Roberts.
Amongst all of the issues that are troubling Americans today, and it's a laundry list, terrorism, the economy, unemployment, housing, education, you know what I find interesting? That the number one reported concern amongst residents of the state of New Hampshire is substance abuse. Isn't that interesting? Substance abuse, their number one concern. Apparently rampant, taking place particularly amongst kids. And of course, when we talk about abuse and addictive behavior, it comes in a very broad variety of forms. If I talk to you about addiction, I think a lot of our minds immediately have a picture in our mind of either the hobo on the street that has the alcohol addiction problem, or maybe the individual that's dealing with drugs and has a drug addiction problem. But growing percentages of Americans, in addition to dealing with sort of the traditional addiction, so to speak, have a variety of other addictions. And it can be as broad as not just illegal drug addiction, but legal or prescription drug addiction. Then you move into other categories. You think about it from a biblical perspective, there are people that are addicted to food, people that can be addicted to spending, gambling, things of that sort. As we talk about the broad level of addiction and addictive behavior in America today, and by the way, 30% of Americans, one out of three of us, struggles with a form of addiction of one sort or another, you would think perhaps the best place for these people to go would be the church. But the church could help them address their addictive behavior. I mean, after all, doesn't the Bible talk about all these topics? Well, it certainly does. And yet, sadly, the church seems to be ill-equipped. It almost acts as if we're sort of out of sorts on this topic. And so we feel as if, well, if you come to us with an addictive behavior, we'd immediately need to give you a referral to AA, Narcotics Anonymous, something of that sort. But could we change the face of addiction if we changed our attitudes about what addiction is within the church? To get some insights now, Jonathan Benz joins us. Jonathan is a clinician. He is a certified professional who serves the recovery community. He is the author of a new book called The Recovery-Minded Church, Loving and Ministering to People with Addiction. And Jonathan, thanks so much for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you for having me, Craig.
What about this observation? From your perspective, is that a fairly legitimate claim to say that largely the church seems to be kind of awkward at dealing with this topic?
I think your comments are spot on, and that's certainly my experience. Having been blessed enough to have been raised in a home and a congregation that was remarkably recovery friendly. When I started going out on my own and doing both clinical work and work in the church, discovering that while for decades churches have allowed AA and NA meetings to take place in basements and fellowship halls, most of those people who go to those meetings would not grace the doors of the church for any form of worship or participation in Christian community. And I think that's largely due to the shame and the stigma that oftentimes addiction carries in the church world.
But that's odd, because as I delineated, you know, when we think of addiction, let's apply the more broad definition to it than what seems to be kind of the narrow traditional approach. Most people, if you say addiction and do a word association game, will, you know, say alcohol, drugs, things of that sort. And yet, as we know, both from a scriptural standpoint as well as a clinical standpoint, that there can be all kinds of other dangerous, addictive behaviors. I mean, there are ministries now that are dedicated to do nothing but helping people, for example, that struggle with sexual addictions or gambling addictions. So it seemed to me that given the broad nature of this behavior and the fact that the scripture has an awful lot to say about all of them, that if there's any place where we ought to feel welcome, where an addict ought to feel welcome, it ought to be within the church.
Well, and one would hope. It's interesting that the American Society of Addiction Medicine defines addiction as a chronic disease of brain reward, motivation, memory, and circuitry. And when the medical community defines addiction, drugs, alcohol, gambling, those things are not mentioned. Those are but symptoms of something else that's going on. So we know that there's something that's happening physiologically in the brain of the individual, and I think sometimes that's the part that we in the church community don't get or don't fully understand. We think that addiction is something that can be prayed away. And while certainly I believe prayer helps in some form of prayer and meditation, we know through science now definitely helps the brain heal, it takes more than just prayer and Bible study for a person to heal and recover. It takes some form of medical treatment as well.
To a certain degree, then, are some of those behaviors, let's take alcohol. And we know certainly there's a physiological aspect to that addictive behavior, drugs too. But to a great degree, is that oftentimes, and as I think you're suggesting, Jonathan, symptomatic of something deeper going on?
Oftentimes, addiction experts will say drugs and alcohol are but a symptom. Or sexual compulsivity is a symptom of something deeper going on. Now, we do know in the case of alcoholism, science tells us that there's a genetic marker for alcoholism. And, you know, we don't quite know if there's a genetic marker for sex addiction yet. Maybe we'll find at some point that there is. But sometimes it's a chicken or egg discussion, you know, which came first. And I often say it doesn't matter whether something of trauma happened that got the person into addiction, or they had a genetic marker that led them into addiction. We got to treat it. And when we want to treat more than just the symptoms, we want to treat the deeper issues of the psyche, or within the Christian context, we would say the soul or the spirit.
Now, the church, of course, would typically look at many of these on that laundry list that we mentioned a moment ago and say that, well, the answer, of course, is Christ. And we can help an individual by leading he or she to saving knowledge of Jesus Christ. And once they start attending church, going to Bible study, things of this sort, that most naturally then, that life-changing experience, that encounter with Christ, should then address the underlying issues regarding their addiction. And so once they've been able to then, through a process of prayer and counseling, things of this sort, overcome that addiction, that they should be done. In other words, there should be no need for ongoing recovery workshops or things of this sort. We oftentimes even hear something, well, people, you know, that once they get through their addictive behavior, then they get addicted to recovery. Is there something wrong with that approach?
Well, I think if we take that approach, then we should do the same with other diseases, with other disease states. We certainly would never tell the cancer patient to stop her chemotherapy, or we would never tell the diabetic to stop his insulin or watching his sugar levels. We know that there are certain disease states that are chronic, and apart from some kind of miraculous touch or miracle of science, the person will continue to have to treat that for the rest of their lives. So, some people, they struggle and they say, well, it's a sin to be an alcoholic. Well, if that's the case, then perhaps it's a sin to be a diabetic. We don't stigmatize people who suffer from other disease states that are often characterized by relapse. Yet with addiction, it is one of the most undertreated issues in our country and one of the most deadly. And I think the beauty of the church, when the church wakes up to the realization that, yes, we hold a lot of answers for spiritual healing, for psychological healing, when we practice that with good medicine, that a person can really increase their chances of finding a life that is happy, joyous, and free, as the big book says. I think when we really grab hold of that, we can begin to see greater transformation in people's lives in our congregations, and also create an atmosphere where it's easier for people to talk about these issues that maybe they would be ashamed to even confess.
Well, and maybe then, too, the approach needs to be with the understanding that an individual that is struggling with an addiction, while we kind of traditionally think it as an individual who is weak, who doesn't have the kind of will or ability with them to push themselves back from the table, the drug, the alcohol, whatever, but rather to recognize that in our fallen condition, we are vulnerable to sin. And it is a day-to-day struggle. I mean, if Paul had to struggle daily to die to the flesh, and I think Paul, both in terms of his encounter with Jesus Christ on the road to Damascus and the role that he played in the early church, probably a little closer, a little deeper understanding of these principles than just the average Christian out on the street who just casually reads Paul's writings, that if we acknowledge the fact that it's a day-to-day struggle and that in and of ourselves we are powerless, but through Christ we can overcome this, and recognize the fact that it's not necessarily just somebody who's got a weak character, but rather it's part of the daily struggle to the flesh, maybe then this sort of stigma that's attached to addictive behavior by the church would be less so, and as a result, people would be more willing to find the kind of help they need within both Scripture and the church.
I would concur, and I would go on to say what I'm not saying. And what I'm not saying is that there are not what we would call sinful consequences of addiction. So if the mother needs a handle of vodka because she's alcoholic, and she drives to the liquor store and she leaves her child in the hot car in the car seat and turns the car off to go in to get her alcohol, and the child dies, is that a sin? Definitely there are what we would call within the Christian context sinful consequences, or definitely harmful behaviors, destructive behavioral patterns. But I think we have to reframe the conversation, as you're saying, to say, yes, we know that there are these behaviors, there are patterns of behaviors, and that really there are principles, spiritual principles in the Scriptures that can help you break free from those destructive behavioral patterns that actually propagate the addictive cycle in your life.
Jonathan Benz is with us tonight. We're talking about the recovery-minded church, loving and ministering to people with addiction. We'll take a brief time out to come back to more of the conversation as Lifeline continues.
3-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.